And now, welcome to The Approach with Jeremy Seaholm, Danny Finn.
So welcome to The Approach podcast number 52. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Dan Finn. I already lost count. I'm glad you're keeping track.
Well, it's because it's only been like three episodes since we kind of...
I still don't know.
So we went in a little bit different route this time. We went with basically Candlepin's resident mechanic, Scott Moore. Scott, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing fine, Jeremy. Thanks for asking.
I've been meaning to get in touch with you to get this done for a while, just because I'm as a mechanic, Candlepin mechanic, former Candlepin mechanic myself, I'm always interested in another mechanic's story, I guess.
Yeah, no, it's, you talk to a whole bunch of mechanics, they all sit down in a room and you end up, you know, hearing all these weird stories about all these weird things that happened. And, you know, it's kind of fun. And you're sort of in a small little group of people who know what you're talking about. And everybody else is like, huh?
So going further back, like who introduced you to the game itself?
Oh, my mom. My mom totally introduced me to the game. I was 4 years old. And she was in a housewives league at Sammy White's, the Sammy White's.
Yeah.
And every time that they would go bowling, me and 25 other kids got stuck in one of the pool rooms behind the Candlepin lanes. And sometimes, if I was lucky, my mom would let me bowl a couple of games. And that transferred into Don Deroni, who was the manager at Sammy White's at the time, who was also a really good bowler. And unfortunately, he was part of that incident at Sammy White's in 1981. He told my mom, he said, you know, hey, Scott's got a pretty good average here. You should let him bowl in the league. And she's like, well, he's only four. He's not seven like the league is supposed to be. And Don's like, just tell him he's small, you know. So that, I never ever thought I would be a Candlepin bowling mechanic, but as a kid, I always imagined what the machines were like.
And yeah, it's funny. You mentioned Don Deroni. His son, Don Deroni, was a bowler in Mills for a little while.
Oh, cool.
He made New England Candlepins too, didn't he?
I don't remember being on New England Candlepins.
I think he did. I think he.
I hate to say it, they blend together.
It's true. That's true. So yeah,
I'm guilty of being on the road too much to even be able to see any of that stuff. So I try to catch it when I can, but
you're on a whole nother part of the alley nowadays.
God, yeah. I don't even see the front desk anymore. I don't even know what a front desk looks like anymore.
So, I mean, as you got old, did you stay bowling in leagues as a kid, you know, through high school and stuff?
I did. My parents, they moved to another part of town. We moved away from Sammy White's. But I did end up, you know, we did have a T bus route near us. And in my high school years, we used to try and get on the bus and find all these weird little basement places. So we used to go up to Needham. Needham had two bowling alleys back then. Mm-hmm. The bowl away was one of them. So it was always kind of cool later on when I took that over. It was a place I bowled. Mm-hmm. But we would go to Newton Corner, which was a 10-lane basement place. They had those bowl fast machines like they have at Westport Lanes. And that place was noisy as all hell. We went to Brookline Street Bowling Alley, which became the Middle East downstairs. And Liz took me there for a concert. And I'm like, hey, look, the bowling lanes are still here. And she's like, my God, really? So, yeah, that was the high point of the concert for me, was finding the bowling lanes were still there. But any place that was like up a flight of stairs or down a flight of stairs, man, we tried to go there all the time. Kenmore Square, we were there a lot and stuff. Any place we could get on the tee with those weird sort of places.
Those are fun. Those are kind of few and far between now, aren't they?
On almost every single block in downtown Boston or in the neighborhoods, there would be a 4 or 6 lane bowling alley that people would walk to. And this was in the days before machinery or anything else like that. And people would just walk to the local, there was a basement and there was 4 or 6 lanes in there and people would bowl. And of course, machinery, there were places you couldn't get the machines into. There was no parking to keep the place viable, you know, once people started using cars more frequently. And, you know, a lot of those places are now gone, but, you know, Needham is still there because there's a parking lot behind it. Mm-hmm. Northborough's got one that's in the basement, Sawyer's. Yep. I think there's a parking lot there.
Small one, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, it's only a six laner. How many parking spaces do you need?
That's true.
Yeah, but you got to have something. I know East Milton as a bowling center still exists down there. There's still eight lanes down there, but there's no, I mean, the on-street parking is like 30 minutes or less. And Liz and I had looked at it at one point in time, maybe 20 years ago now, to try and see if we could get that resurrected. And, you know, but without any parking that you can secure, it was just pointless to even go much further.
The only two alleys I know of that don't have parking now, I've never been to Ron's, but I've heard that their parking's tough. And then CPL are the two.
Ron's has a municipal lot across the street.
Yeah.
So that helps. Central Park, yeah, good luck. Yeah, you're finding parking there. I just
go to Shaw's. I'll walk.
That's what I do.
Yeah,
I don't even try.
That's one place you can go. And as long as they're not like real hardcore on who's actually there.
There's no way they can tell it. Because there's so many stores. So you have the Shaw's and then all that strip mall.
Yep.
So there's no way that they, I mean, I'm not saying no way, but like, yeah. I just have a hard time believing that someone's out there checking to see how long the car has been out there.
There's only one person that I know of that got ticketed, and I don't know if it's true or not, but the only person I heard of getting a ticket was actually Surrett.
Really?
Yeah.
That's probably because somebody ratted him out.
Probably the same guy that sends him those love letters of
there you go.
Ruin the game of bowling.
There you go.
It's all your fault, Jeff. So, I mean, fast forward a little bit, what made you get into purchasing Needham?
Well, that was sort of an interesting story. I was at the, just before I purchased Needham, I was working as an EMT. And for many years, I loved working as an EMT, but it's starting to get burned out. And the worst thing in the world that I thought in that whole business was a burnout, because then they're not listening to the patient anymore. They're not taking care of things. And I was looking back on all the jobs that I had working in different places. And I really just wanted to find a place to work that I loved. And I was bowling in Malden at the time, and Danny Ryan was there. And he said, you know, I somehow had mentioned to him that I'd gone up to Stowe and took a look at the Kroll Bowl. And he said, you know, Needham Bowlaway is available. Al Wallace is looking to sell it dirt cheap. The place is in okay shape. You know, it's only eight lanes, but, you know, I mean, it's a lot less work than 16 lanes in order to make it, you know, make it viable again. And I did some numbers on it and everything. And of course, you know, Needham, Wellesley, Newton. I mean, how do you go wrong with those?
Right.
And the only thing that I was thinking of with the Bowlaway is that it kind of needed a niche. You know, you had Fairway was 7 miles away in one direction. Norwood was 7 miles away in another direction. And Big League in West Roxbury was still in business at the time. And they were another 7 miles. Yeah, that was a funky place. That was, I like that. You know, Tony Nally had a nice little place there. But, you know, none of them did cosmic bowling. None of them were, you know, like real buy it. I was going to do cosmic bowling and spent way more money on cosmic bowling than, you know, people were recommending at the time. Big speaker systems, subwoofers behind the bowlers. You know, I mean, like we'd make the whole two-story building up above us thump while we were doing cosmic bowling. And, you know, the neighbors were like, oh my God, this is just insane. But everybody came in and we had a line of people out the door. And, you know, that was where we made our money, was on the cosmic bowling and the birthday parties.
I mean, what kind of condition?
Have you seen some of the cosmics they have now where it's like, I'm sure it's overhead lights. I don't get how any of that works, but like it tracks, like the light will go behind the ball. They got like the fish tank one. You can go.
Yeah, I mean, there's some really cool stuff that's out there now. The technology has gotten a lot better. We had a series of lights that would turn on periodically during the show and make the lanes sort of look like water. Oh, but so cool. It didn't have the chasing effect that they have now, because now it's got that stuff kind of like you see it in an airport, you'll see like a projection on it's like, you know, koi fish, and kids can run over it. The koi fish run away from the kids and stuff like that. It's all computer controlled now. I mean, and I've been to Bowl Expo before and seen some of the stuff that they have, and it's just totally money to be able to put it on there. But it's some of the stuff is just phenomenal. We could either pre-program in a show that it would do, or it was sound activated and stuff. And we could do all kinds of different things. I remember we had for St. Patrick's Day, we would normally make all the pins green. And Jeremy, I think you remember, we used to do 1-2-3 ball in Sunday mornings.
Yeah.
And there was a 1-2-3 ball that we did. And I think we were using 4 or 5 lanes. And of course, all the pins were green. We weren't doing Cosmic at the time, but all the pins were green. And Sammy D'Agostino punched a single pin. It went into the backstop and came up and rolled off the lane. And I heard the kid like 2 lanes over go, "Daddy, did you see that? He hit that pin so hard he knocked all the green off of it." So I remember that. That was awesome. But we always tried to have fun. We always tried to do things a little bit differently. I wanted a league and tournament base big time. And I could never make my league business more than 10%. In the place. So we rocked open bowling and birthday parties as much as we could.
I mean, I know your league money, I mean, that's your guaranteed money, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's your open business. I mean, that's really where you need your bread and butter.
Yeah. Well, that was it. Yeah. Go ahead, Dan.
I was going to say places like, I know Penn's and Milford, they don't even do leagues. From what I heard, they said they can make more money off their open bowling than they can in any league.
Well, you know, we had a when we started doing the Cosmic Bowling, that was first and foremost. I sunk so much money into getting the electric updated for the bowl away. I mean, it was 60 amp electric in that place when I took it over. I mean, I can't even imagine running 8 of those machines with the old motors on them on 60 amp electric. I'm surprised the place never caught fire. Although Al Wallace said the place flooded so much it couldn't catch fire, you know. But I mean, I just went in there totally with Cosmic Bowling in mind. And once the first bunch of kids came in and saw the Cosmic Bowling and that we were doing the Cosmic Bowling birthday parties, everybody had to do a Cosmic Bowling birthday party. Our reservation book was full going 3 months out. And, you know, the beauty of it was, you know, we were making a prepay for the first 10 kids. Mm. The beauty of it was like the Fenway Park effect. You had no idea if your birthday party was going to get rained out or not. And if you didn't call the bowling alley 3 months early, you weren't getting a spot. Kind of like Fenway, you know, all the games in the end of September are gone long before they've even thrown the first pitch. And okay, it may suck if they're way out of contention at the end of the season, but if they're World Series bound, you certainly want to be there.
Yeah. I mean, it must have been, you know, word of mouth. I mean, I don't think, I mean, Needham's not huge, right?
Needham had a population, I want to say it was about 30, maybe 40 something thousand people at the time.
Yeah.
I had done a demographics thing. We had 30 something thousand people within walking distance.
Yeah.
Of the bowling alley, you know, within like a 15 or a 20 minute walk. And then of course you had Wellesley and then you had Newton. I don't recall getting much from Dover. We did get some from Dedham, but the other thing that we had going for us is, you know, Newton, Wellesley, Needham, these were all towns that had money.
Oh yeah.
You know? So, you know, I mean, it gave us the ability to sort of provide this sort of specialized type of bowling, the Cosmic Bowling. And even though we had a small place, you know, I mean, if we charged $30 an hour, the best we were making was $240 an hour with all 8 lanes running, which really isn't that much.
Did you serve beer at all? Or
they wouldn't allow us. The town would not allow us to have beer. We had to, the only way they said that they would allow us to have beer is if we had 100 seats for a restaurant and we served a 3-course meal, then we could apply for a liquor license. But I only had 4,800 square feet to work in. Yeah. Where the I wouldn't have had any bowling.
I was going to say, at least if you were selling beer, you could get some actual, like not actual, some extra money coming in as well. Right. Especially if you have like a Friday, Saturday night group coming in.
The present people running it can serve beer. I know that that would be, you know, even if you limited it to sales after 6 o'clock at night, you know, and made it a 21 plus or whatever after that, if that's what you needed to do, you'd make a fortune in there.
Yeah.
Now, do the Sunbergs still own it?
Last I heard, they do. They're running it now. But I don't know how they're dealing with the business. In our case, we were leasing the space. The lanes were ours. The lanes stayed with the building. The machinery was ours. And, you know, the landlord at the time effectively forced us out of there. Not a nice guy. And anybody who's interested in opening up a bowling alley or taking over a bowling alley where there's a lease involved, you are really at the mercy of the landlord. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the original landlord in there was a really super nice guy. And he even told me that way back in the day, he set pins in that very place. So he always had a soft spot for the bowling alley. But once the new people took it over, they didn't care.
I mean, when I was in talks with PJ to start working at Millis, one of the possible plans was they were actually looking at Needham before before the Acton took it over. And their plan was actually to send me there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you'd have done fine there because you knew how to work on the machinery.
Yeah.
And it was a nice little place. I mean, I think the part I loved about it, it was like running Cheers. I mean, we knew everybody coming in the door. We saw families coming in with kids, and we would do the kids' birthday parties every year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're there for 11 years and you're seeing kids coming in, growing taller and taller and taller. You know, it was a ton of fun to be a part of that. And you kind of felt like part of their family in a small way, not a big way, but, yeah. You know,
even in Millis, I felt the same way. I mean, obviously we were a lot bigger than Needham, but you know, I was there 10 years and I saw kids that would show up from the Fairway Kids League, you know, when I was like close to them, like Sean Ahern. I remember when he was 8, next thing I know, he's coming up to me for a Coors Light. And it's crazy. Like how, you know, some of those, not all the families, but you know, a good number of families you become friendly with, you know. And
yeah, oh, absolutely. And they grow up really fast. I mean, Cam, my son, he was a baby.
Yeah.
He was born the first year I had. Yeah, yeah. He was born the first year. Like I say, you joined our team. We figured this out because Liz had saved all of the paperwork from the bowling alley for, you know, going all the way back. And I'm like, you know, we got to get through it, go through this stuff and see what to get rid of. And she's like, well, we got to get your 649s. And, you know, Cam was born the day later I was bowling and I threw my high five 649. The following week you joined, we had Dave Driscoll bowling on the team beforehand. And I don't know what happened to Dave.
Double D.
But yeah. And then you came the following week and I threw another 649 and you're like, wow, nice team, you know. And, you know, shortly thereafter, I went back to Earth. And we had so much fun there. I loved that place. I really did.
I loved that league. That's where I got my first taste of like the three-man teams. Mm-hmm. And I loved that. Like Needham was tough, but I feel like it was fair tough, I guess, you put in steel decks, I think, at one point.
Yeah, I put in steel decks as I wanted to be part of the NBA. Needham hadn't been part of the NBA for decades. And Bill Bolton came down with Dan Ryan and they looked at the place and they measured everything. And they're like, well, OK, here's your deficiencies. And I think I had two of the old phenolic decks had more than 1/16th of an inch depression. And he said, you got to get this fixed. You got to get some curtains fixed and whatever. And we just said, we're doing it, you know, because I really wanted to have leagues and tournaments in there. And I was really, you know, I remember walking all around Needham trying to get people interested in leagues and stuff, and it never panned out. But we did put in the steel decks, we put in the 3/4-inch gutters, we put rubber kickbacks, you know, rubber blisters on the sidewalls, built in the sidewalls as much as we could. And the only thing that I don't like as a bowler, and this frustrated the people who came over from big league, is I don't like when the lanes are slathered with silicone. I think that that helps your lesser skilled bowler all day long. It does not help the skilled bowler. And the head pin is supposed to be the best hit. And when that was how I wanted to set Needham up. I didn't want it to be too tough, but I wanted it to be that if you hit the head pin regularly, you would get good drops. And, you know, Danny Harris and Jeff Surrett certainly didn't have any trouble in the States. I know they threw 13 something down there. Yeah. Both of them, they tied. They had to have a one string roll off. And, you know, it was, I mean, the pins did fly. And Al Wallace, who was the previous owner, said that Tom Olstead had been down there and he threw 7 something in there like it was just another day in the office. So, and that was when he had the place. So I don't even know what kind of shape the place was in back then. But I know Al hadn't seen a can of silicone, and I don't know. But we had to spray the decks because with steel, especially down in the basement, the steel would rust.
Yeah.
And so we had to keep them treated so that they wouldn't rust.
So, I mean, that was, I forget who got me to join that league. I don't remember if it was Paul Willits or Jason Doucette. I don't remember. But that was like the beginning of me kind of hanging out with that group of guys, like Paul, Stu, Doucette, Gothier, like great, all those
great bunch of guys.
It was so fun. That became like the clique that I was like inherited into, kind of thing. And, you know, we got out a little bit later. I want to say we got out at like 11 o'clock, something like that. And then we'd go to Uno's afterward. Like it was just a fun, it's just a fun experience. I actually have one of my 690s. It was either 689 or 690. I did that in the States, actually bowling with the mixed doubles with my wife.
Yeah.
And I was more proud of that 689 than the other one that was at Metro.
Yeah. I mean, when I, you know, it's, I always kind of think it's funny because I think my average topped out at 118. But I don't think I ever bowled regularly at a fast house. And, you know, maybe if I'd have bowled in Park Place or something, maybe it would have been a little bit higher, one low 120s. But yeah, I miss it. I wish I could still bowl there. Actually, the best night I had in Needham beside the 649 is Liz would have killed me if she was there. But I was bowling in a men's league down there and I was sick. I had the flu and I was like, they were like, come on, you're going to bowl. You know, I'm like, I'm just here to open up the doors. I am so sick. I just can't do it. And they were like, come on, you can bowl. You can bowl. And they brought a trash can over the lanes for me in case I, you know, got sick.
Pre-COVID, you were allowed to bowl sick.
Yes, exactly. And I think I threw 420 for the night. And the funny part was, is it was all, it was 138, 140, 142, something like that, you know, just, and, you know, and then as soon as I get off the lane, they'd be like, okay, here's the trash can, stay here, don't go anywhere.
I think sometimes, like, if you're not hurt, but like sore or sick like that, sometimes, I mean, it can go the wrong way, but like my high five, I told my team, this is actually this year, a few weeks back, I actually told them, I said, listen, you're going to have to carry me because I had bowled the night before. My leg was killing me. I don't do well back-to-back days. It's tough bowling when you're a fat guy. And for first three boxes, I think I had 25 through three and then through the double and then just – and I think it's because I bowled slower because I couldn't push as hard as I wanted to. And just doing that kind of – I wasn't so focused on I have to have a good score. It was let's just get through 5 strings. And somewhere in the middle of it, I realized I had a good stretch going.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is, too, is when there's something wrong with you – you simplify your game.
Yeah.
You know, you're just focusing on, okay, I just want to get the ball down and hit the head pin. And you really simplify the game. And then when you can figure out how to do that when you're not sick, you know, it actually takes you to another level. I kind of wish my knee was better. My shoulder was better. I mean, it's a, and you know, I kind of wish that because Cam was begging me to bowl. It was like 2-3 years ago. We went to Timberlanes and joined a league there. And he was just like, I really want to bowl in the league with you so bad. So here I come, the old guy in with the young kid. And there was a team that needed two bowlers. And they're all excited because here's this young gun showing up. And he winds up and throws the ball 100 miles an hour. And here's the old guy. And he's just laying the ball in. But I never threw a string under 100 until my knee popped on me. And all of a sudden the knee popped and I could barely walk. And I'm like, oh, God. And I've got to get to work the next day. And I said to Cam, I said, I'm really sorry, buddy. I can't do this anymore. You know, this is going to kill me here. But, you know, you got to think, is the bowling more important than the mortgage? But yeah, I think when you simplify and you can learn how to simplify the game, you do much better.
I do have a question too. Now, before you took over Needham, did you work at an alley before that? Or was that your first instance?
Oh, Kenmore Square.
Kenmore Square.
I was in college. I was a freshman or a junior in college at Northeastern. And, you know, my mom said to me, well, you know, I'll help you pay your college tuition, but you're going to have to pay most of it. So here I am taking college classes 20 something hours a week, and I'm working 50 hours a week part time. And my grades suck because I don't have time to do homework and sleep. You know, it's not even like I'm trying to have a social life. I'm just trying to keep the college bills paid. And, but yeah, I worked at Kenmore for several years, and that was kind of what got me into it. That's what reminded me, you know, hey, working in Kenmore sort of is what, when I looked back on all my jobs, I thought, you know, geez, I always had fun in the bowling alley and I'd really like to work there. So that was the direction I went.
So the reason I ask is because, like, when I first started working, and Jeremy, this is going to kind of be a question for you as well. Like, for me, you know, bowling was kind of the thing I did to not think about work, not think about, you know, it was just, you could shut off everything and bowl. But then when you work at a bowling alley, like now it's becoming a job. And I was just wondering, like, that's going to be so much more when you're running the place as well. Like, and what, do you lose that love for the game a little bit when you're running, you know, Jeremy, you were the manager, Scott, you were the owner. Like, do you lose any of that, like, thrill of it? Like, how do you keep the love of the game when you're also worried about things like you said, the rent and the electricity and the customers through the door?
Well, my love of the game didn't change. I would always, whatever things were slow, if I could, I would go up on the lanes and bowl. So that didn't change. The thing that did change is that I'd be like, okay, I've got some downtime here. There's no customers walking in the door. I'm going to bowl on alley three and throw three strings and, you know, see what happens. And I turn on alley three and it's running for a few minutes. And then all of a sudden I hear squeak, 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 squeak. And I'm like, this is killing me. I can't do this. So I put the bowling balls down, get the tools out, go down and find out what was squeaking. And then by the time I come back, it's like, you know, people are walking in the door again. And I'm like, well, at least the machine's running. I'll practice again. But no, it was for me. No, it didn't change for me. My passion for the game stayed. My problem was, is I did not have the time with an 8-lane center to get out of there and go bowl. My first year that I had Needham, I was on the Pro Tour, the WCBC Pro Tour. And I would say I missed the first stop because I couldn't get there because I couldn't leave work. The other five stops I got. So my one throwout stop was just because I couldn't get there. And three of the five times that I did go, I was getting phone calls like, alley two isn't working now. How do we fix alley two? You know, alley six broke down. What do I got to do with that? You know, and I'm trying to throw 10 strings, 10 decent strings. And that's when I was just kind of like, yeah, this is not meshing real well. You know,
it is,
especially.
It is tough, especially, you know, when we were going through like the just before COVID and going into COVID, when I was able to get a Sunday off to go do something, do a tournament, stuff like that, you know, whether whoever was working, you know, Sundays, Danny, you didn't typically work, but, you know, I'd get a text or this and that or a phone call. You know, I'm trying to focus on what I'm doing, but I'm also watching the cameras. You know, I'm doing this. Like, I was doing literally everything but paying attention to bowling.
Right. And it takes it away from you. You know, you're missing the, you know, you're trying to stay in your own head for bowling. And when you're stepping up on the lane and, you know, Liz or somebody has called up and said, you know, the sweep ran, but the tubes aren't running, and you process for, you know, everything that's going on in the machine. And meanwhile, you're trying to, you know, you're saying to yourself, Jesus, I got to just focus on hitting the head pin, but this is my livelihood on the other end. And, you know, yeah, I suppose if I was like an elite bowler, maybe I would have stuck with it and put up with it. But, you know, it was just too much to try and travel and chase tournaments and stuff. I did try and do a couple of Comcast roll-offs. I did stay bowling. I did keep my average up. And I loved it, but I just didn't travel. If it was something that happened in Needham, I was there. If it was something that happened elsewhere, unless it was close by, I typically didn't go.
Yeah. I mean, even to this day, if I'm bowling Outrun the Bear, like, my eyes still go everywhere. I'm still watching every single lane. I'm still, you know, if a lane breaks down and, like, I'll look to the counter, I'll see if, you know, Matt or Ezzy or whoever, like, goes to, like, fix it. And, you know, if I don't see someone move for like 10 seconds, I'll be like, shit, like, am I up? Like, do I have time? I could probably bang that out real quick. Like, literally, like, I still think that way.
Right. Or worse yet, they've been down there for 10 or 15 minutes.
Oh, I still do.
And he'll go down. Yeah. Well, that's it. But I mean, unless, like, if you're trying to focus. Unless
somebody from insurance is watching, then Jeremy never goes down.
Oh. Well. But no, it used to make Liz upset because, you know, she would go down and work on the machines, and she was really good with the machines. But, like, sometimes she'd have something that was sort of a bigger issue or whatever. And I would go and walk down the lanes just to make sure everything was okay. I didn't want to take it away from her. I didn't want to be like, you know, hey, you got to do this or whatever. I knew if she needed the help, she'd call me or come out and say, hey, I can't figure this out. But, you know, when they go down back for like 10 or 15 minutes, you're thinking to yourself, Jesus, is she okay? Is she stuck in the machine? You know, your mind just sort of goes all these different places too, especially knowing what the machinery is. And, you know, and then of course, you know, did somebody huck a ball? Did she get hit by a pin? You know, I've been down back and pins come flying up from out of the machines. Balls come up the down sweep, hit the wall behind you, stuff like that. I mean, it's like sometimes if the place is really busy, it's like being in a war zone.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're trying to duck everything flying. So it's not as easy as it looks.
TikTok back and forth with somebody because Kate and Carrie have their TikTok, and they did a thing where it's showing how far away the pins were that you can fit two candles and bowling balls between any set. Mm-hmm. And somebody's like, be careful you can't get hurt, or be careful you don't get hurt. And somebody writes, you can't get hurt on candlepin lanes. My grandparents own lanes and the sweep. And I'm like, I wrote back. I was like, they for sure can. I've gotten two good ones from the sweep.
Mm-hmm. Especially and you guys have these. Oh yeah. The E machine is dangerous. I mean, yeah. I was bowling at a league night in Malden, when Malden still had E machines, and I was on, I think it was on either 17 or 18. And I don't know, Jeremy, do you know John Connors?
Yeah, he's up in Wakefield now, I think.
Yeah, he's working in Wakefield, right. So John Connors was behind the counter, and I was bowling the league. And this was when they still had Alley X. So the league was taking all 22 lanes, and they had somebody bowling down on Alley X. Somebody walked down the lane to go clear a piece of wood or something like that, and their friend thought it would be funny to push the button on them. Well, the sweep board came down right on the lower back. And John saw that from behind the front counter, and he's running across the concourse with people bowling. I ran diagonally across 18 lanes to get there and try and get that sweep board off of him before his back was broken, you know, because if the breaker didn't pop, if the thermo didn't pop or something like that rigid sweep, that'd do a number on you. But thankfully he was okay.
Especially the angle that it comes down.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know, absolutely. If you're laying on the lane, like I know Danny almost got decapitated once.
That was one of them, yeah.
It's people don't understand that. Like we had a league bowler that did that at one point too, and the thing came down on his back.
Right. Yep. And I mean, the good part is that unlike a 10 pin machine, a candle pin machine won't kill you. At least the bull Morris won't kill you.
It just maim you. That's all.
Yeah. You could lose a finger, or you could lose a couple of fingers. You could lose a chunk of hair. But yeah, I don't think that there's anything in there that can kill you.
The injury that I got was, a ball had come down off our ball returns underneath, and a ball had fallen off, and the league was over. And I know when the league's over, you can throw 30 balls down. There's no reset. It's not counting scores anymore. Mm-hmm. And I saw the ball underneath, and I leaned down to go. So I went down. I went to go get it. Well, I didn't know that once you've knocked down all the pins on certain lanes, it'll just automatically reset. Well, I'm wearing a black shirt. Because
the camera doesn't see any pins anymore.
Yep. So I leaned down, and it caught me right in the back of the head. So it was the sweep was to my right, and it snapped my head the other way, luckily. And PJ said he thought if I was a little bit further to the right and it caught me right on the neck, he's like, that could have been it. Like, he thinks that I might have been.
That would, you know, something with that sweep on the Model E, that would not surprise me.
Yeah. It went away.
Yeah. That is, of all the machines, of all the Bullmore machines, that is, in my opinion, the most dangerous part of that machine is that sweep, that rigid sweep there. Machines that have that sweep that when it comes back, it's swinging back and forth. I think most people know that one.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can still get caught on the old style, though. I was in flatbread one time, and my ankle was right where the sweep was coming down, and somehow I missed it. I didn't get the switch or something like that to shut it off, and the sweep came down on my ankle, and it pinned me there. Now, it didn't hurt. The breaker popped, but now I'm trying to finagle this thing, you know, backwards or forwards, just so I get my ankle out and not look like an idiot stuck in the machine.
So I had that happen to me on lane one. I'm Jeremy. I don't even know if you know the story. I just happened to be walking back, and I stepped on like the gutter right as the sweep came down, and it pinned, like it closed my shoe from the back. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Huh. Now, I think if I was by myself, I probably could have like got it out, but I probably would have like healed myself with a sweep. And I saw my nephew Matt was down the end. I was like, "Hey, Matt, come here for a sec." He's like, "Everything okay?" I was like, "Yeah, come here." And he comes back. I'm like, "Can you rotate the sweep motor up? Because I'm stuck." He's like, "Are you really?" I was like, "I'm 1,000% stuck right now."
Yeah.
It wasn't hurt. Like you said, it wasn't painful. I was just, it caught me like at that perfect spot where I just couldn't move.
Yep. And once that breaker pops, there's nothing moving that until somebody moves it off.
My second or third week in Millis. You know, it was a Monday night. Yeah, because I was working, Bill was there. So tubes got stuck. I go out back, and I was pissed at myself after this happened, because, I mean, I've always told everybody that, you know, I've worked with, new to machine, stuff like that, first thing you do, kill the switches. Mm-hmm. So I'm undoing the tubes. I shut everything off. For some reason, I didn't shut off the tubes. And when I was undoing the tubes, the tube belt was a little like I wasn't getting like grip on it. So I grabbed like a pair of like mechanic gloves to give me some extra grip. So I'm moving the thing. The tube motor started up with my hand around the belt and pulled these two fingers into underneath the pulley.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I just lit there. I like held my hand like here. I just sat there and just waited to hear the click.
Mm-hmm. And that's a smart move, because what a lot of people try to do when that happens is the instinct is to pull.
Yep.
Pull your finger away from it, but your fingers are trapped in there. So you don't want to pull. You want to go for the ride, wait for the breaker to pop and do that.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, and Danny, since you're still working at the bowling alley, when I run the tube belts, I use my foot.
Yeah.
I don't use my hand.
So the way these are set up, it's fairway was the same way. I would always use my foot. The way these are set, it's weird and it's awkward. It's almost like
it's got the cage.
Yeah,
it does. Yeah.
Yeah, you've got the cage in the way, but you can still sort of use your foot, because, you know, that's a place there, especially with that big motor on there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's going to suck your finger in, and that, of course, it's going to hurt. but you know, it's just one of those little tricks that the tube motor is one of those ones I just don't grab it. I use my foot on it as often as I can, but you know,
I just sat there. I turned it off and I'm like, please still be attached. Please still be attached. Please still be attached.
Yep. Yep.
And it was, so, I still have like a pretty deep like scar on it. I come up front, it was like bleeding, this and that. Bill, this guy, he's like, oh my God, what happened? I'm like, we got to fill out an incident report. I'm like, leave it alone. Like, I'm running to CVS real quick. I grabbed like a thing, I taped it up. I'm like, I'm fine.
Yep. Yep.
Now, high school, I went to a tech school, and one of the shops we took, because we had to do exploratory, was automotive. So I did it for a week. But the guy had told us that when you're a mechanic or any type, I'm sure it's working with your hands, the two times you're most likely to get hurt is when you're first learning and you don't really know what you're doing, or when you've been doing it for 20 years and you're so comfortable that you just think, you know,
absolutely
thinking. In the middle ground, you're usually pretty good. You know, all the safe, you're doing all the safety procedures and you know enough to keep yourself safe. Once
when I started working at Boston Bowl in Hanover, we had 10 pin machines and 12 candle pin machines. And the head mechanic for Boston Bowl said to me point blank, if I ever see you in a 10 pin machine and the main power plug hasn't been removed, because they had plugs on those, and you haven't disconnected that plug and that machine isn't stone cold, if I find you in the machine, you will be fired on the spot. Any employee. And I took that to heart, because it was like a couple of years later, there was a guy in Ohio. And he was working on a 10 pin machine and he was wearing a hoodie and went into the machine to just go, you know, it was just absolutely insane to think that that could happen.
No, I've always said that I want no part of 10 pin machines.
Nope. Nope. I mean, I've worked on them. I will work on them if I have to, but not my favorite.
We got a few questions from people. Brendan O'Dowd actually asked, I wanted to bring this up too. What were your experiences being part of the ICBA? What would you do differently, if anything, and what were some of the ideas you didn't have a chance to see through?
Well, there was one, I think we had a conversation online about it a little while ago, that I really wanted to try and press through, and it involved the Loblaw. I've always been frustrated with the way the Loblaw gets dealt with in the game. It was great with Channel 5 that they had Ralph Stewart or anybody of his predecessors there to sort of watch the Loblaw. But as a tournament director, I really found the Loblaw to be a pain in the tush. And I'm being very polite saying that. Because
you can say ass.
I don't know how PG rated we want to make this, but it was awful. We had a tournament at the Bowl Away years ago, and there were two people who happened to be up at the same time bowling on the same part of the shift, one on one side of the house, one on the other side of the house, and about half the balls they were throwing were out over the lob line. And I got to tell you something, when you're trying to bounce around between two people like this and you can't change the lineup and you can't do anything else like that, and you're the only official there for those eight lanes, that was nightmarish. And it's just like, you know, we all know we got to keep the ball down. The bowling is rolling the ball. It says it right there in the rule book. And I've heard of other people who are just like, you know, look, if you can't keep the ball down, I'm just going to disqualify you. It's not going to make any damn difference anyway, because if I keep taking away every single pin on every single lob, you've got no chance of winning this tournament at all.
Yeah.
And I had proposed making the lob line, and they felt it was a little too draconian, that if you can't keep the ball down, you know, sort of a three strikes you're out type of thing, or five strikes you're out, whatever. So that this way here, you know, you get so many warnings, and after that, you're just, you can finish, you can bowl, but we're not going to count your scores in a tournament or something like that. You know, I mean, you're running a bowling center, you're trying to turn a profit in there. How many officials can you have for so many lanes to make sure everybody's doing it? And, you know, I think that you know, my feeling is if you lob the ball, it's the same as throwing it in the gutter. And you know damn well if somebody threw the ball in the gutter, everybody in the place is going, you can't take it. Mm-hmm. But somebody lobs the ball and they're like, there's only got one out there.
There's a push to eliminate that rule altogether. I've been seeing more and more people say that I don't agree. And I respect the people who say that it doesn't, but they don't think it creates a competitive advantage. But I just can't wrap my head around the idea that if the ball's on the lane for a less period of time, it doesn't help. It has to help.
Well, the thing is that if you've got a spin on the ball and you throw the ball in the air, your ball is going to go straight until it hits wood or synthetic or whatever. But the primary reason that the lob line was put in that I found out is to limit the amount of lane damage to that first 10 feet of the lane. And you have to understand something within like the ICBA. The ICBA is a proprietor's organization, not a bowler's organization. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing I'd like to change. I'd like to see the ICBA become a little bit more bowler centric, like have people like yourself, sort of like the USBC, but people like yourself, Danny, and whatnot, be able to sign up, pay a membership fee, right, and then be able to get some benefits out of that, including like, hey, you broke your first 200, we're going to send you an award, or you broke your first 150, we're going to send you an award type of thing, you know? But yeah, it's as a proprietor's organization, a lot of the rules get set up in such a way as to make it a little bit easier for the, you know, for the bowling center and the proprietor. So like, that's one of the reasons we have a deadwood line 2 feet out in front of the head pin. If a piece of wood rolls 3 feet, 4 feet up the lane and somebody tries to play that piece of wood, yeah, back in the day when you had a pin boy back there, you got a kid who's like a target at that stage in the game, yeah, or, you know, the machinery is going to get smashed.
And ball shoots up, hits the pit light, you know, and you got shattered glass everywhere.
Exactly. Exactly. Jeremy,
I don't even know if you know this, but we had somebody from one of the leagues that is not competitive at all. And they had a piece of wood that was way out and they played it and it went up and hit the cubica box.
Yeah.
And it killed the system up top. Luckily, once we shut everything down and turned it back on the next morning, it was good to go. But I called Mike McCarthy, or I think I texted Mike McCarthy, the company mechanic. And I said, what does this code mean? And he said, how do you know what that code is? I said, it just popped up on the TV. And he wrote back, that's not good.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, I mean, I personally, if they did away with the lob line, I'm okay with that. But yeah, then I've heard of other people like in duck pin and 10 pin, even, you know, 10 pin, they've got like a 16 pound bowling ball. They put some kind of an oil pattern down. Somebody doesn't like the oil pattern. The next thing they're hefting the ball 20, 30 feet down the lane, yeah, which on a synthetic lane, it's not so bad because the synthetic will take the abuse. But on a 10 pin lane, once you go 14 feet down the lane, they switch from rock maple to pine. And, you know, if you've got a whole bunch of people doing that, now your lane looks like the surface of the moon. You know, you can't do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, whether they change the way it's interpreted, the lob line is interpreted and say, well, you got to try and keep it here, but we're not going to treat it like a gutter ball or whatever. I just think that they need a better way of dealing with that. Yeah. I personally, and I don't have a preferred way of dealing with it. I mean, I agree with some of the other people. I don't really think that there's an advantage or a disadvantage to lobbing the ball overall.
You don't, but I feel like there, I mean, I think I feel like I'm now in the minority, but
I feel like you're going to be less accurate if you lob the ball. I don't see how you can be accurate that way.
Well, the other thing is too, is the trajectory of the ball coming down. If you have any spin, if you do like Don Richmond and you get down way low and that ball starts skidding when it hits the lane, Don releases that ball, there's spin on the ball, but it's skidding over the top surface of the lane. It's not hitting real hard. Don's got more accuracy that way because the ball comes out of his hand and he knows the way it's coming out of his hand, and the ball will break a little bit with the rotation on the ball, and that's all fine and well and good, you know.
Too though, like when you think about like the speed on the ball, like obviously accuracy is way more important than the speed, but the mm-hmm. speed definitely helps. If you can hit the pocket a little bit faster, you get more pin action. Mm-hmm. If you have to drop the ball at that lob line, that's 50 feet that it's going to be on the lane before it touches the head pin. mm-hmm. where if you can lob it 20 feet out, now you're only 40 feet. Like it's, mm-hmm. I don't know. I just feel like there's these little things. Yeah. I know a lob cost me 6 points in an ACST match.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, I was bowling in 20th Century Lanes in Hyde Park back when they still had wooden lanes in there. And Alley 8 had this, they had the Guardian stuff on the lanes at the time. It was like that thin Mylar stuff to protect mm-hmm. the top of the lane. And so the approaches had been sanded many, many times, but the lanes hadn't been sanded because of the Guardian on there. And it was this little uprise on lane 8. And we used to do this tournament Sunday mornings up there, Matt Dennehy and a few other guys. Dennehy. Yeah, there's a name for you, huh?
Matt Dennehy.
Dating myself. Yeah. And I threw the ball and I hit the foul line, and the foul line had this like pitch up. And the ball went sailing through the air. I swear to God, Jeremy, I thought it was going to go right through the middle of the masking unit when they had those old Brunswick masking units with the yep. big crown. I yep. thought it was going to go
right through it. That's crazy.
And that's a good on picture. The red stripe. And I got a strike out of it. And it was a totally legit delivery because yep. I got the ball in the lane before the lob line. But I wouldn't want to have to throw balls like that. You know what I mean? And of course, I can't imagine. I never went down there at that time because I wasn't a mechanic, but I wouldn't have wanted to see the crater that ball left when it got down there.
Nick Norcross wants to know, why is lane 9 in Somerville so damn slow?
Only because he bowls on that lane.
There you go, Nick.
Yeah, there you go, Nick.
but he says, just kidding. What are your thoughts on the future of a newer Candlepin machine so the game can potentially expand?
I think that a new Candlepin machine is right now on paper in pieces and parts. Wink, wink, nod, nod, nudge, nudge. Yeah. It's only on paper at this point. And of course there's, you know, lots of different versions of sweeps, lots of different versions of different things, you know, rumbling through and sort of like, what would we want to prototype? What would we want to try? One of the big things for me is that Candlepin bowling will not succeed over the long haul if it remains just in New England and Canada. I think it needs to get out of New England. And when the future of your industry is dependent upon the number of 70-year-old bowling machine frames that are still in existence, that's not a good place to be. And I don't know if either of you guys had ever seen it or not. There was a video online of Todd Leiter's machine that they tried up in Westbrook, Maine. They had 14 lanes. It was I think the concept of it was that they were supposed to be able, you could run Candlepin out of it, or you could run Duckpin out of it. It was supposed to be computer controlled, and it was supposed to be able to do all the different games somehow. But I don't know all the details in it. All I know is that at some point in time, they gave up on the machine and they put in, you know, Z4 machines and string 10 pin. And, you know, I think COVID killed the place anyway. But yeah, I you know, something, the new machine will be sort of Bullmore-ish. I'm not going to go. I don't think going with a Janes machine, as cool as that might be, or going with any of the other machines out there would be where I would want to go. I think the Bullmore had the right idea with Keep It Simple.
Cam actually asked, having been in the pin setter repair industry for years, what has been the strangest issue you've ever seen on any Candlepin machine?
Well, staring into a pit and seeing my son in the pit is way up there on the list. I mean, not now. We've been doing this now for 5 years, and it's kind of cool having father-son projects when he's 22 and I'm 56 and we're working together, and that's a lot of fun. But, you know, the first time, you know, I'm looking in the machine and I'm seeing my son in the pit working on something on his own, not daddy telling him where to put this.
Yep.
That was pretty strange. As far as a strange problem, was lane six in Needham. Always had this thing where every two or three days the pusher bar would stop halfway through pushing the pins out, and it would cause a pin jam because now the pin lift starts running. I could never figure it out. I changed all the parts out of it. And of course, when you're running a bowling center versus just being the head mechanic, you don't get as much time to spend with it as you might like to.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was probably the weirdest one there, in the sense that I just was never able to figure it out.
Dan Esdale wants to know do you know of any houses that still use or had operated AMF candlepin machines?
Yes, Norwood is operating them, and I believe that there's a house up in Maine that they told me about, but darn if I could remember what town it's in. As a matter of fact, Norwood has given me two of their control boxes that they can't fix. And I contacted my source at AMF, who managed to find me the schematics for the candle pin control box, so that I can go through the schematics and go through the box and try and figure out what the problem is with these boxes. Wow. Because they've got a stack of them up against the wall, and apparently they get to a point where they just can't fix them anymore. And then they throw all, and they get more from another place that closed. They run those for a while, and then those break, and then they shove them up against the wall. And so, yeah, I'm hoping to be able to resurrect a few of those for them. And then I'll find out from that place in Maine, too. It doesn't look that hard. It's just a matter of, you know, now that I've got the schematic and going through it, I should be able to get that fixed for them.
Yeah. Now, I usually kind of finish up with, I know you're more mechanic, you know, proprietor side, but who's your guy? Like, you watch the bowling shows. Who is your guy? Like, who did you really enjoy to watch?
Oh, I'm going to go with the standard answer, Tom Olsta. Yeah, Tom Olsta all day long. I was, like I told you, I was a kid and I grew up bowling at Sammy White's. Now, the league I was on, we had 34 lanes of four-person teams on this kids' league. And that was the 9 o'clock shift. The 11 o'clock shift had another 20 lanes of kids on that. So 54 teams of four people on a team. How's that for a kids program?
Jeez.
And every once in a blue moon, you would end up on lanes 37 and 38, the TV lanes. And everybody on the lanes was like, okay, I'm Tom Olsta, I'm Peter Flynn, I'm so on and so forth, you know? And oh God, a funny story. I was at Tom Olsta's Hall of Fame induction because Liz was the executive director for the ICBA. And I'm in the house and Liz says to me, hey, guess what? And I said, what? And she says, I'm holding Tom Olsta's Hall of Fame tickets to get him into the place right here in my hot little hands. And I'm like, oh, can I touch them? And she's like, I don't know. I don't know if you can. And I'm like, oh, can I touch them, please? You know. So she put them in an envelope and she said, here, you can touch them like this. And I'm like running around the house going, squee! I get this Tom Olsta ticket. So later on, I'm at the induction ceremony and I'm waiting to get a drink at the bar for me and Liz, and who pulls up behind me but Tom Olsta. And I'm usually pretty smooth and I'm, you know, pretty fluent with English and everything else. And I turned around and looked at him and held out my hand to shake his hand and said something unintelligible and completely stupid. And he kind of gave me this strange look like, are you a bowler? And I'm like, well, sort of, not quite. I'm Liz's wife. I mean, husband. I mean, like, I don't know what the hell I mean anymore. So yeah, it was Tom Olsta without question.
Which is funny because he's such like he's just a normal guy. But I know. But like, and, you know, and I felt like the same way. Like when we interviewed him. I mean, and I had been around him before. I've been paired on a TV roll off with him. Like, mm-hmm. I know he's like, you know, one of the nicest guys in the world.
Yep.
But like,
yep.
he came walking into Millis, and I went and shook his hand, and he's just like, hey, like, you know, Jeremy, yeah, nice to meet you. You know, I'm Tom Olsta.
Yep.
And like, I tried so hard to force myself to not say something stupid.
Right. Right.
He's just a normal guy.
Right.
I love the story. Right.
He's just one of us.
I love the story too in that podcast when he was talking about the friends he's made through the game. And he goes, you know, I'm sitting in a room with you guys for 2 hours and I consider you guys friends.
Yes.
Jeremy is retelling the story. He goes, Tommy also said he's my friend.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But you know, and I mean, this is the thing. It's like as being a proprietor and being a mechanic. I mean, like I talk to Tim Lipke all the time, mm-hmm. you know, and we give each other crud online and stuff like that, you know, or when we meet each other in person. And it's like, I don't have a problem with Tim Lipke. And Lipke's up there in the same bowling royalty as Tom Ulstead. But I've known Dan Murphy, knew him through the ICBA. We talked a lot. We talked a lot about bowling. You know, I mean, all this stuff. I mean, there was a lot of people in there. But I think it's because Tom Ulstead was in Florida most of the time that
I was an adult. Around.
No. And my mom was a huge fan of Tom Ulstead growing up. I was a huge fan partially because of my mom. And it was just, you know, I mean, I think there are certain things that get etched upon you when you're a child. And now all of a sudden you get a chance to meet this person and they're larger than life, even though they put on their pants just the same way as you do. You know, Craig Holbrook, I love Craig. You know, we've talked a few times. You know, but it was just that first chance to actually meet Tom Ulstead, and I just like an idiot.
my Tim Lipke story, when you're talking about how, you know, he's in that same conversation, but you don't get nervous around him. The first year I bowled in the ACST, I had to bowl Anthony Karen up at Lakeside. And first two strings, I felt pretty good. I bowled well. I mean, well for me, I'm not a great bowler by any stretch. And then I happened to grab a ball and turn around and Tim grabbed a chair, sat down, and he was still like on the carpeted area, but he was right behind us. And I was like, well, time to not embarrass yourself in front of a Hall of Famer. Like all of a sudden I got so nervous. Like I was fine before then. And all he was going to do was hang out and watch. And for whatever reason, I felt like every bad ball I was going to throw, it was going to be like, oh, no wonder this kid doesn't bowl well. Like,
right. Right. Yeah.
I think I was inserting comments that he wasn't making in my own head. Like,
right. I was going to say to your thing, Danny. Yeah, absolutely. Because the first time I bowled in the WCBC, I don't remember how I was doing it, but like I was leading the pack for the first three or four strings. And everybody's like, who the hell is this guy? Right. So then I turn around, I look, I got John Zernike behind me. I got Joe Tavernese watching me bowl. I got all these other people sitting there watching me bowl. And I'm just like, oh my God, they're watching me. Why are they watching me? Go watch somebody who really knows what's going on. And then they're like in first place, Scott Moore. And I'm just like, oh Jesus Christ. I think that, yeah, definitely Tom Ulstead, number one for me.
Well, we're right about at that time where we're about the hour. I just want to thank you for coming on the show. I've been meaning to get you on for a while. You know, you and I go way back, and, you know, I honestly, you know, bowling in your place is still, it's still special to me just because that's where I feel like I got my really, really, really competitive start, you know,
absolutely.
Some of those other guys.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, just an absolute blast. I miss that place. I miss that league. It's just, you know, good times.
Yep. Well, can I give a shameless plug?
Sure.
1,000%.
Okay. So if anybody needs any help with anything, I mean, obviously, if you're doing fine with your mechanical stuff, please stay with whoever you're doing it. But, you know, Candlepin Specialists, that's our company now, and we're focusing all on Candlepin. If there's anything that we can do to help you out, Liz, you can call the office. Liz will get you set up for an appointment. We just made a trip up to Maine, met some really nice people up there. We're going up to Boutwell's this coming week and a few other places. And we've got electronics, control boxes, anything we can do to help get your machines ready for the 21st century and beyond. That's where we're going.
You want to drop the number?
781-727 7800, and it's also candlepinspecialists@gmail.com. I think the website's also candlepinspecialists.com. So yeah, we're trying to set up all kinds of new stuff. Yeah, I mean, we want to make this, you know, kind of like that situation with Ellsworth, Maine, that kind of brought to me, like, there are a lot of people in the industry who do not know where to find help, where to find parts. And we've walked into some places, not necessarily on this past trip, but we've walked into some places and you can't believe some of the stuff people have tried to do in order to make these machines work. And it's like, you know, we do have the parts for that. We could make this work, you know? So, and it's all about making it better and keeping this game running for as long as possible. I was not an all-star bowler or Hall of Fame bowler, but if I can do this to do my part, along with everybody else to help make Candlepin survive and make it better, I'm in.
Yeah. No, I mean, the game is much more than just the bowlers, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But, thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me. It was a blast.